This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Today I'm joined by Professor John Syriadakis, who's the Director of the Laboratory of Astronomy at Aristotle University. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Oh, thank you so much. I enjoyed my lecture today and I'm enjoying talking to you.
And you did your PhD at Manchester a while back, didn't you?
Lovely times, back in 71 to 75.
And that was back when the University of Manchester was still the Victoria University of Manchester.
Indeed, yes. And UMass was different.
And you lived, I guess you lived at Jodrell Bank.
Well, there were no premises at Jodrell Bank. I lived in Alderley Edge with Richard Davis and other friends that were here today.
Yeah, with lots of academics who we've interviewed here in the past. Yes. And Ian Morrison, who does our Sky at Night.
Yes.
So you were here giving a talk on the Antikythera mechanism, which is, well, I guess the best way to describe it, you're one of the leading experts in the subject. Could you tell us a little bit about what the Antikythera mechanism actually is?
Well, it was an astronomical computer. It had input, output, and it had a way of doing calculations through gears. It was calculating the position of the sun and the moon. It was calculating and forecasting eclipses of the sun and the moon. And it was also it had a well-made user's manual because it was a complicated device.
Listening to your talk, some of the stuff is incredible about how they've actually manufactured this thing. Could you give us a little bit of history on when it was discovered?
It was discovered by chance in 1901 by some fishermen, probably it was sponge divers. And once the discovery was made, a few months later, the whole crew of archaeologists and other personnel from the Greek Navy, they collaborated and they brought up several artifacts, statues, jewelry, glassware, and the Antikythera mechanism.
A couple of months is quite a quick turnaround for discovering something to actually bring it up, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. This is something that couldn't happen today, I think, with all the precautions and the bureaucracy that we have, especially in my country.
Yeah. So what drew you to first look at this mechanism? Because your research is in neutron stars and flare stars and, wow, pretty much everything, the center of the galaxy. But you're also really interested in archaeoastronomy. So what drew you to this particular area?
I haven't said this before, but my mother was an archaeologist. She worked with Sir Arthur Evans in Crete, and she gave me the microbe of archaeology through the blood that she transferred to me. So when Mike Edmonds gave me a ring and said, well, shall we try to make another investigation of the Antikythera mechanism, I was very happy, except I did not want to do the bureaucracy. Mm. I called a colleague of mine, and he said, yes, I will do the bureaucracy for you, but you do the astronomy. Fair enough, he will do it, but eventually his health deteriorated, and I had to do everything, and I was not very good at bureaucracy, so it took us 2 years before I got the permission to actually investigate it.
What sort of bureaucracy does happen? How do you get to the point where you can actually pick up this thing, this fragment, which is so old and so precious?
Well, I think the archaeologists are the guardians of our inheritance, the guardians of history. So they're very, very, very careful what they do and what permissions they give. At the beginning, they did not understand what we were trying to do. They did not know what X-rays really mean. They did not know anything about gears. They did not know that by studying the number of teeth of cooperating gears, we can understand what they are doing. Mm. So it took us a very long time until we persuaded them that it's going to bring new results. And it has brought new results.
Yeah, it's incredible. Could you quickly give a description of what the Antikythera mechanism is today, what you actually see when you have the pieces out in front of you?
Well, they're fragments. They're calcified fragments of gears, plates, and pointers. And luckily, having the very high-resolution tomographer that we used, we can go through it. We have a resolution of 20 microns and read letters, see the gears, how they cooperate, where the axes are, where the shafts are, and this is what we do.
So layer by layer, you can strip down
yes.
micrometer by micrometer and just unravel yes. what's going on in a really non-invasive way. Which is
yes,
really
yes, exactly. exactly. Non-invasive way, well said. Mm. The problem was, of course, that the fragments were not flat. When we're reading a text, It was not to read the text on a two-dimensional flat space.
Is that because it was made in not a flat way? Or was it because it's been battered and beaten by the waves?
It was battered and bittered and calcified and broken. And maybe there were earthquakes there that the stones came down and destroyed it a little bit here and there. We found only about two-fifths of the mechanism.
Wow. So only less than 25% of the mechanism
yes.
you've got there. But from just looking at the gears, you can tell what they do.
Yes. And being astronomers, we know some periodicities. We know how the planets move. We know how the sun and the moon move in the sky. So by studying the ratio of the teeth, of the number of teeth of the gears, we can calculate what they do and then see if you have, say, a train of gears, the first gear transmits rotation to the second one, to the third one, to the fourth one. So you have to take the ratio of all of them. So like 223 divided by 5, times 24 divided by 7, etc., etc. We can calculate what is the output at the very last end of the gear train, and then we know what they did, this gear train, what they did.
And how many gears have you got? How many gears do you know what they do?
Yes, we have found and we know for certain that we have about 30 gears. In our reconstruction, we used a few more gears, but they were certain what they were doing. So we were not questioned that there would be some other gear. Because, for example, if you find a pointer saying Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, etc., etc., and you do not know what gear was going through this pointer, then you say this gear must have 7 teeth. So a full rotation will give you a weekly calendar.
So I'm guessing there's a 365-toothed gear?
Yes, okay. There's the gears with 365 teeth, the gears with 223, 224. The smallest one has 9 teeth, etc., etc.
And how big is the biggest one, and how big is the smallest one?
The biggest one is 30 centimeters in diameter, and the small one is less than a centimeter. It's about 0.762 centimeters.
So these things, which were crafted from bronze?
Bronze, a combination of copper and tin. In fact, tin was produced in Britain. I mean, most likely the tin could have come from Britain.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
Wow. So is that one of the biggest reserves of tin found in ancient Europe?
Well, for ancient times, it is known. There's the traveling experience of Pythias the Greek, who traveled from Marseille, Massalia in Greek, to maybe up to the Orkney Islands. And he describes step by step where he went through, what was the shadow of the sun, so you know the geographical latitude. And he did certainly go through Cornwall. So this is where you have your tin mines.
And it's amazing that, well, some of the stuff that you make it from could have come from all over Europe. And actually, this was found in a shipwreck. Could you give us a bit of history about why it was found off an island called Antikythera, where it gets its name from? How did that come about?
Yes. One of the things that I do not know, and I will start from this, is if it was found in the front of the ship or in the back of the ship. In 1900, they did not record everything accurately. If it was found close to the captain's quarters, this could be a navigational instrument. We have found the word sun ray in the text, and why should an ancient person write the word sun ray on the text? Probably, maybe they had a kind of bamboo, and they were pointing at the sun, then measuring the height of the sun. In the same way, they could do the same for planets or for stars, and this is the beginning of actually finding geographic longitude, which is very difficult to find if you do not have a timepiece, but maybe this can be done with tables.
But even 2,000 years ago, I guess this was.
About 2,000 years ago.
And you know that because of the font that's inscribed on the instructions to this mechanism. So could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, yes. So the Antikythera mechanism has about 3,000 letters on it that we have found, must be many more. And by investigating the style of the letters, we can calculate the age. So, as you say, the font used by the ancient technician, we can calculate what is the age when this machine was built. Nowadays, we are trying to find out through calculating the eclipse cycle that is on the Antikythera mechanism. And this is also gives us a date around the 2nd century BC, as we had calculated from the style of the letters.
So they match. That's
yes.
Well, that's a good result to show that you're on the right track. But coming back to what we were talking about. So it was on a ship, and the ship sank. What else was on the ship?
Oh, there were lots of lignin. This is a material made out of clay. In fact, this lignin, these pots, in the ancient times, was what we have today is a plastic bag. So they were actually transporting goods through clay pots. And if they had transported wine or olive oil, then this should be discarded because you cannot put anything else in it. So one way of actually finding out the ancient trade routes is to follow the fragments of broken clay. And this was done by a British archaeologist, and we now know what are the trade routes in ancient times between at least Marseille and Northern Europe. So we have found 104 statues or fragments of these statues, legs, head, bronze arms, etc., etc. It had very good artistic glassware. It had some very nice jewelry. In fact, Monica Jackson from Australia, she has studied these cosmetics, this oil effing they found there, and she has found copies of this in several museums around Europe. One of them is in Delos, one was in somewhere in the Eastern Europe. And so I think what has happened at Delos, which is like the Cayman Islands of the ancient times, so no taxation, there was somebody who was making this jewelry, and then he was selling it. So this is why some was found at Delos, and some was found in other museums. Very, with high similarities like the ones at the Antikythera mechanism. Mm. So this boat probably, which is a very large boat, probably started from Ephesus, Pergamum, because coins from that era were found, and then it went to Rhodes, Kos, maybe to Symi, maybe to Paros, and then was going through the Straits of Peloponnese to Crete, and there it sunk. So it had been collecting, should I call it loot? Maybe.
A ship full of treasure.
Is it full of treasure? Yes. Maybe some of the statues, they are not of very high quality, so probably it was quickly made, and they want to actually give them as ornaments at the villas of the nobles, the nobility in Rome.
So you mentioned that some of the jewelry found on the ship has been found elsewhere. Do you think that there could be another Antikythera mechanism out there somewhere? Is this a one-of-a-kind object?
I don't think it could be one of the time objects, because when we made it, we made so many mistakes that they made parts of it, and then the other part wouldn't fit, etc., etc. We discarded the first part. So I have the feeling that probably the Antikythera mechanism was made, first of all, it was a very good collaboration between a very good scientist and astronomer and a mathematician, and a charismatic artist who actually did the inscriptions and the cutting the gears, etc., etc.
It also had a use in predicting the Olympic Games. Who would have required something like this?
Well, it didn't have really a certain aim. I think it was probably an educational instrument. I can imagine Aristarchus or probably Hipparchus in Rhodes on the stadium there, that he had his observatory, gathering his students around him and having the Antikythera mechanism there in front of him.
And doing astronomy outreach.
Yes, like, look at this star, it's moving like this. Let's look at it on the Antikythera mechanism. And the moon, did you observe the moon? Did you see what is the phase of the moon? Let's rotate the Antikythera mechanism dials and find today's date. And look, the phase of the moon is exactly what we see now.
So in a similar way to an astrolabe is at an observatory now.
Yes, yes. This astrolabe could also be an astrolabe. We have found some evidence recently.
Mm. You said that whenever you study it, it brings you completely new ideas on what else it could do, because obviously you haven't found everything yet. Have you got any up-and-coming theories about new parts that you've only just discovered?
This is very, very, very difficult to say, because we still need to investigate lots of things. Of course, I think that we do have the equation of time, which is something completely new.
Could you, for our listeners, could you quickly tell us what the equation of time is?
Oh, this is the difference between the time shown by a sundial, and because the moon and because the sun moves faster and slower as it moves in an elliptical orbit around the Earth as they knew at this time, they does not show the evenly flow of the mean solar time that our watches and our clocks show. You know, our clocks do not go faster and slower. But the sun does move faster and slower. But don't forget that the year is the rotation of the Earth around the sun. The day is the rotation of the Earth around its axis. So they're all astronomical calculations. So the difference between the shadow of the sun that shows on sundials the time and the mean solar time shown by our watches is the equation of time. It starts in January being negative, so we have to subtract a few minutes, goes further negative, then goes up again. It becomes positive, and again around June, then again negative, very negative. It goes all the way up again, become very, very positive. The very, that they say, is something like between 14 and 16 minutes.
Does this equation change depending on where you are in the world?
It doesn't change on geographical latitude, but changes with time. Mm. And this is because we have the precession of the axis of rotation of the Earth around the axis of the ecliptic. The ecliptic is the orbital plane of the Earth around the Sun. So the axis of the ecliptic is perpendicular to this plane. And the Earth's axis forms 23.5 degrees around this axis and moves like this in 25,000 years. So it changes slowly.
Changes slowly, but it's still fairly accurate even now.
Oh, yes. It changes about 30 degrees per 2,000 years.
I think it keeps better time than my watch, actually.
Okay, yes.
But there are some things that change with the latitude that the object is at, which is have given you some hints as to where it was actually used. Is that correct?
Okay, I did not explain this during my lecture. Let me explain it now. Mm. The Antikythera mechanism had inscribed in the front panel a parapigma. Now, a parapigma consists of astronomical events that happen once per year. You probably know that as the Earth moves around the Sun seems to be projected at different constellations from day to day or probably from month to month. There are 12 constellations in the orbital plane of the Earth around the Sun, which we call the zodiac constellations. So you are a certain zodiac and I'm a different one. From day to day, the Sun, as it moves among the stars, it goes close to a star, it passes it, and then it leaves it behind him. As the Sun moves close to the star, suddenly, there's one day that's so close that the star cannot be seen. The Sun sets, and the star sets behind him, but the Sun is so close to it that the star cannot be seen. This is called in ancient Greek the epitole, which is the closest point of the Sun to this star, during the setting of the Sun. The same thing then goes on. The Sun comes closer and closer to the star. It goes past it. And at daytime, when the sunrise comes, the star, rises first and the Sun behind it. You cannot see it. After a day, the Sun moves away by 1 degree away from the star. Another day, another degree. Eventually, there comes a day that the star is visible for the first time this year on the sky. This was a very, very important date in ancient times. For example, I know that the morning rising of the star Sirius, the brightest star on the sky, was very important to the Egyptians because the flooding of the Nile was coming immediately after, bringing new and fertile land in the Egyptian plains, and the pharaoh or the king was offering a big prize to the person who come to him and say, well, look, I have observed the morning rising of the star Sirius. There are events that happen once per year, and they also depend on the geographical latitude. Mm. So the sequence of these rising and settings that I described are different in the equator from the North Pole. In fact, in the North Pole, probably you know that the Sun doesn't rise for 6 months and rises. So, by studying the parapigma, we have found that the Antikythera mechanism could be used between 33 degrees geographical latitude and about 38.
Does that rule out Egypt? Could the person who owned this have? Yes. Couldn't have got the prize every year.
Yeah. We are surprised that it rules out Egypt because we're expecting to have some connection with the Egyptian calendar. Mm. In particular, because the calendar in the front side of the mechanism has Egyptian names. Okay. All of them were written in Greek letters, but it did have the names in Egyptian, not the Greek names. So we're expecting to have some connection with Egypt, but the parapigma tells us that it could not have been used there.
Wow. Do you have any idea why? Or is that one of the mysteries that is to be?
Because it was not made there. Mm. Although, of course, Alexandria is well known from ancient times, from people that constructed automata, like Iron of Alexandria and like Ctesibius, people that actually made some automatic machines to impress people. And these machines, though, impress us as well.
It impresses us all these years later, yeah. One question that I see you're asked a lot, which is a very good one, is this machine heliocentric or is it a geocentric machine?
The machine was a geocentric machine. So if you see in the front dial, you have the Earth in the middle, and the pointers of the Sun, the Moon, they rotate around the Earth, around the observer. So it was a geocentric machine. However, I'm pretty sure that the guy that actually made that anti-Kithra mechanism knew about the heliocentric system, but it was a heresy at the time. So I presume he did not want to say this, and even more, to construct such a system.
Would you say it's easier to construct a system like this for heliocentric versus geocentric?
By far easier. I mean, it is easily explained, the positions of Mars and the orbit of Mars and the planets around the Sun is much easier to explain with the heliocentric system. For the geocentric system, you have to have epicycles and different centers that the Earth is. There's also a different center in the solar system. I have the feeling that Aristotle used 53 cycles and epicycles for his model of the solar system in order to justify all the peculiar movements of the moon and the planets and the sky.
Yeah, it's incredible because that all boils down to some very fine mechanisms. And I've seen some of the shafts and some of the gears you showed them in your talk. They're just so precise. Were these made by machine tools or cutting materials?
Yes, we have found quite a lot about it in the literature. In particular, I would like to stay on a tablet found in LFCs. It is in a museum there. One can find it, where it describes buying of poles and square parts of the columns. You see,
so
in the ancient times...
List.
A shopping list. Who wants a shopping list? Okay, an order, a shopping order. You see, in the ancient times, when they built a monument or the Acropolis, in the middle, they used to put some metal. And this metal has to be very precisely made. And this is, in Eleusis, is a description of a shopping list by somebody who would like to order things for doors to be opening and closing. And it particularly it says that you should lay the poles round so that they move freely inside the square parts of it, which have to be cut very accurately, and the side should be square and not deviate from this specimen that I give you. Furthermore, they should be made out of bronze, and describes that bronze is 11 parts copper and 1 part tin.
So it's a very bespoke order.
Very, 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 very precise order.
That's just sent to some craftsmen.
It's like my wife giving me a list of shopping, and I have to go to the supermarket and say, what is this? I do not know what it is, but please give it to me.
So do you know if this mechanism was created all in one piece, or do you think it's been created over a period of time?
That's a very good question. First of all, you have not found in the anti-Kithra mechanism who constructed it. So we have not found the made in China. He's not there. We have not found it.
Would something like that have had a signature somewhere? If you have
we have been looking at all the gears. We have been trying to find if there was a signature, and we have not found one. At least there were not that many astronomers that could do the maths and the astronomy, which is inbuilt in the anti-Kithra mechanism. I did mention Hipparchos a couple of times. Also, some people have suggested Archimedes, but Archimedes died three generations before the Antikythera mechanism was constructed. He was killed, and Syracuse, where he lived and worked, was destroyed by the Romans, and so no laboratories were actually left behind. So I can see that maybe somebody started working on the front part of the mechanism, describing the position of the Sun and the Moon, how fast the Moon moves. You know, the Moon moves once a month around the sky. The Sun moves around in 360 degrees and per day for sunset and sun rising. So maybe somebody actually did this reconstruction of the front part. And then somebody who's a very clever person said, well, we can use the same movement of the sun and the moon to calculate other things. So they added the backside. Could be. We do not have any more evidence of what I'm telling you, but it could very well be.
This mechanism was lost, and there are no other examples of this in existence. How long was it before the next astronomical clock or something that did the same sort of thing as this came along? How many years?
Yes, I see your question has two parts. The one is why this technique was lost. That was the time that the Greeks were completely captured by the Romans. And what I see is that that a bird does not sing loudly and well in a cage. So artists and scientists probably did not want to work under oppression. The Romans were very good in road building, but they were not good in geometry, in astronomy, etc., etc. Then the other thing is, how long did it take until you calculated and made another machine which was similar to the Antikythera mechanism? I know of two other machines that were made before the Prague clock. Mm. One of them was made here in England. It was made by William of Wellingford in 1261, but it was not as complicated as the Antikythera mechanism. And the other one is the Astrarium of De Dondi in North Italy, maybe around Padova, I'm not sure. The device that actually resembles in many aspects what the Antikythera mechanism did is the Prague clock, that if you go there, you can admire it and know that some parts of it could be taken from the Antikythera mechanism.
That's amazing. And that was maybe 1,000 years later that was created. 15 centuries later. And we still don't know everything that this mechanism does, because we don't have everything from it.
Yes, it's nice not to know everything, isn't it? Mm. I mean, just imagine if you know anything, life is going to be boring. So yes, every time that we actually investigate the Antikythera mechanism, we seem to be finding new results, and then we have to go back and investigate these results, read new journals, new books about the knowledge of the time of the Antikythera mechanism, and see if what we have found was well-known knowledge at the time, or if it's something completely new. So there's a challenge with the Antikythera mechanism. Every time that we look at it, we find something new and we do not know what it does.
And are you tempted to go back and look for more gears at the bottom of the ocean where it seems?
Some marine excavations are being organized in collaboration between the Woods Hole Institute in Boston, United States, and the effort of marine archaeology in Greece, with very good results. I can describe some of them if you would like to. But we have not found anything about the Antikythera mechanism. They have found lots of other things concerning statues, concerning, a spear, a very, very well-preserved spear. They have found lots of metal parts. I do not know the very latest thing. I have to see one of the PhD students of the Aristotle University, who is an archaeologist and an architect at the same time. And he's a diver as well.
So he's perfectly equipped to grab everything.
He's the best person to actually go down and investigate.
But you will be back in a few months' time to give another talk at Manchester, is that correct?
Maybe. Nothing that has been fixed yet, but if it does...
Well, if you are, hopefully we'll be able to grab you again, because I could talk about this all day. It's really cool. But it would also be nice to talk to you about your research. So it'd be lovely to have you back on the Geocast in the future.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to coming back, if I may, in Manchester, a place that I spent many of my years. Many moments I do remember from my studentship here at Jodrell Bank and at University of Manchester at the Schuster Laboratory with my professors. I think that the only moments that we actually have lived are the moments that we remember. Mm. Any other moments that we do not remember, they have just passed away from us. We do not remember them. We do not live them. Mm. So I have the feeling that it's nice that I came back. So many good and sweet memories came back to me.
This was the first time you've been invited to speak at Manchester since
Correct.
You left.
Correct.
Which is scandalous, really. Hopefully.
Okay, I have spoken in Oxford and have spoken in other places as well, and many other countries in the world.
Well, we really hope to have you back again. But thank you. This has been fascinating. Cheers.